And here's some startling statistics. The number of people incarcerated in the U.S. has quintupled since the 1980s. In 2016, it was about 2.2 million people. And the U.S. imprisons people at 9 times the rate of Germany. In fact, author Emily Bazelon writes in her new book that our embrace of mass incarceration may soon come to seem nearly as shameful as slavery does now. And she levels several charges at those who charge people, prosecutors. Her new book is Charge, the New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. She's also a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, a fellow at Yale Law School, and a frequent legal analyst for Here and Now. Emily, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm just going to tick through some of the conclusions you come to. You say prosecutors have become too powerful. You say that the role of a prosecutor has become a stepping stone for a political office, and that is a problem. And that many prosecutors have tunnel vision. Start with the prosecutor as a stepping stone for a politician and a time when being tough on crime is something that wins office. Explain that thinking.
Right. So my criticism of the office of the prosecutor being a stepping stone to higher office reflects a kind of past conception of the office. That conception is that in order to be the DA, you have to be tough on crime. If that's our conception of the district attorney, then the way in which this then becomes a stepping stone to higher office is going to lead to more incarceration rather than a system that's fairer and that can start to cut back on these huge jail and prison numbers that we've amassed.
Well, and also that prosecutors often may have a sort of tunnel vision. And let's talk about one of the cases that you follow. This is a young man with a pseudonym. You've called him Kevin. Grows up in a really tough housing project. Another kid in the project, Chris, has been waving around a gun that he got on social media. He is not supposed to have a gun. He's been in trouble before. So the police officers come to get him. As the door opens, Kevin panics, wants to do the manly thing to protect his friends, and picks up the gun and tries to hide it. And off he goes into this rabbit warren of prosecution. How does your thinking about prosecutors play out in his case?
Well, I think that what's unusual about this case, nationally speaking, is that New York has heavy mandatory minimum prison sentences for possessing a gun. If you possess a loaded illegal gun, you are supposed to go to prison for 3.5 years. That's the most serious charge. And that kind of charge gives an enormous amount of power to prosecutors. They are able to force a lot of guilty pleas by threatening people with prison. And there's almost no discussion about why young men, almost all the people prosecuted in New York City are young Black men. And because there's such a heavy penalty and this crime is assumed to be a violent felony, even though having a gun doesn't mean that you actually used it, those things mean we never talk about why people have guns, well, whether they don't feel safe and whether they're looking for some form of protection. Even if that's a bad call, we're treating them as violent criminals as opposed to people who have life circumstances that explain some of the choices they're making.
Well, but as you explain, there's a reason for this. There are all sorts of programs that are being developed now, diversion programs, so that young men who maybe haven't been violent yet can, or women as well, can go through a program instead of jail. But in one very famous case, it did not work.
Right. So this is a problem of a high profile case in New York City driving a lot of punishment. And this happens a lot, right? It goes back to Willie Horton. We see one terrible crime committed by someone who got a second chance, usually someone with dark skin who scares white people. And then we're willing to throw in the towel on programs that have a good success rate of reducing reoffending.
But Emily, is that fair? I'm going to play devil's advocate here because
sure.
You obviously have a point of view in this book. But is that fair to the police officers and the prosecutors who often work hand in hand? This young man went through programs, was given these chances, and then shot and killed an officer.
Well, you're talking now about someone who was not a good representative of the people in my book. You're talking about a 30-year-old named Tyrone Howard. He had a long rap sheet. He'd been convicted of armed robbery and been implicated in a shooting. The judge who gave him a drug treatment program, this was not a gun offense, didn't know that he was implicated in the shooting, said, I'm giving you a second chance. And then, yes, a terrible crime happened. But that's not a representative case. Yeah. It's a terrible event. But the idea that that would mean that we would unravel all the efforts we're making toward reducing and ending mass incarceration, that seems to me, yes, like an overreaction.
Well, and then Kevin, back to Kevin, did not have that rap sheet. Had just, as we said, done a stupid thing, picked up a gun. But he ended up with a prosecutor who was more reform-minded.
Yes, that's right. His case was in Brooklyn, where the district attorney, Eric Gonzalez, has been talking about making jail and prison a last resort. And so Kevin was given the opportunity for a second chance. It made a huge difference in his life. And yet, because of the ghost of Tyrone Howard, that is a political risky move for the DA's office to be making. And everyone's very aware of that.
Yeah. Now, talk about another young woman you follow, Nora. She was convicted and jailed for the murder of her mother. She had come home early in the morning, she said, and found her mother brutally murdered. She served 8 or 9 years. Was there ever any evidence that she'd murdered her mother?
There was no physical evidence, and the DNA from the crime scene excluded Nora and identified 2 unknown suspects who the police and prosecutors, as far as we know, never looked for. So it's a case in which a lot of suspicion swirled around Nora because of what's called circumstantial evidence. She had been out all night the night her mother was killed, and she also didn't have a father. Her father had been murdered 1.5 years earlier. And so all of those things made her vulnerable to being charged. And the reason she got out of prison was that the Tennessee Supreme Court reversed her conviction because a prosecutor withheld important evidence from the defense.
Well, and you say it made her vulnerable to be charged because there'd already been a murder in her family when there was no evidence. It feels in your telling that the reason she was charged is that there was a very tough-on-crime prosecutor in this case who, at least according to a Memphis judge, Lee Coffey, a former supervising prosecutor in the same county who looked at Amy Weirich's, the prosecutor's, evidence, said he never would have presented that case for an indictment. Does Amy Weirich, in your view, fit into your description of this tunnel vision where a prosecutor might feel, I'm not a bad person, so if I see this way, I must be right?
Yes, I think you are seeing that there. And, you know, one of the reasons why that part of Nora's story is so striking is that it feels so arbitrary, right? Your case could land on one prosecutor's desk and you wouldn't be indicted. Another prosecutor's desk, you end up convicted of murder. And that is a problem with prosecutors having so much power.
Just stay with the issue of prosecutors. And I'm sure some of them hearing this right now are very offended, you know, at this notion that they have tunnel vision or they got it wrong.
Sorry, Robin. Yeah. I haven't actually heard from I'm sure you're right. I'm sure there are people who I'm offended. One always does. I have not heard from any offended prosecutors since my book was released. And I think the reason is that I'm not painting with a broad brush. I want prosecutors to see how much power and responsibility they have, but I also know that most people go into this work thinking they are good people with high ethical standards trying to do the best they can. It's just that a lot of them are operating in offices where the way you get rewarded is by winning big convictions and winning long sentences. So it's a systemic problem.
Look, this is an issue. Over-incarceration that's united, well, you know, President Trump and Van Jones. The Koch brothers have poured a lot of money into criminal justice reform. What about those voices who say, you know, this may save us money, as some conservatives want, in not having that many people incarcerated, but we still fear it's dangerous?
I think those voices are just many fewer than they have been in the past. Crime is dropping in America. That has opened a window for rethinking our system. And there's a crucial insight here borne out by research, which is that when you send people to jail and prison, you're making them more likely in the longer run to commit more crimes afterward, because people come out of jail and prison with more trouble getting a job or housing and in more desperate circumstances. Yeah. And so the idea that you could improve safety by making the system more fair as opposed to more punitive and increase people's faith in law enforcement, those are ways to make communities safer that we have really way underutilized in American society.
In fact, you have a checklist for changing the way things are. More jury trials, fewer plea deals, less difficulty in getting bail.
Yes. Reforming the cash bail system is a huge part of this picture. Two-thirds of the people held in jail right now across the country are there because they can't afford bail. That's 6 million people every year. So just thinking about reforming the pretrial process, these are people who are assumed innocent, right? That could have a big impact. And then there's also the other side. After you get out of prison and jail, we have these very long terms across the country of parole and probation. We put a lot of people back in jail for what are called technical violations, like you break your curfew or you leave the state without permission. These are not crimes. They're only infractions in the context of these 5-year supervision periods that we're demanding.
Just very briefly, how are Kevin, again a pseudonym, and Nora?
Nora is in Brooklyn. She is going to community college right now. She is doing well. And Kevin is in his neighborhood in Brooklyn, and he is working.
Yeah. Emily Bazelon, author of Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. Emily, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.